before, nor from producing in those 12 hours 1,200 articles instead of 120. Nay, more, his working day may be prolonged at the same time, so as to make him produce, say, 1,400 articles in 14 hours. In the treatise, therefore, of economists of the stamp of McCulloch, Ure, Senior, and Tutti Quanti, the like, we may read upon one page that the labourer owes a debt of gratitude to capital for developing his productiveness because the necessary labour time is thereby shortened, and on the next page that he must prove his gratitude by working in future for 15 hours instead of 10. The object of all development of the productiveness of labour within the limits of capitalist production is to shorten that part of the working day during which the workman must labour for his own benefit, and by that very shortening to lengthen the other part of the day, during which he is at liberty to work gratis for the capitalist. How far this result is also attainable without cheapening commodities will appear from an examination of the particular modes of producing relative surplus value, to which examination we now proceed. Chapter 13. Cooperation. Capitalist production only then really begins, as we have already seen, when each individual capital employs simultaneously a comparatively large number of labourers, when consequently the labour process is carried on an extensive scale and yields relatively large quantities of products. A greater number of labourers working together at the same time in one place, or if you will, in the same field of labour, in order to produce the same sort of commodity under the mastership of one capitalist, constitutes both historically and logically the starting point of capitalist production. With regard to the mode of production itself, manufacture in its strict meaning is hardly to be distinguished in its earliest stages from the handicraft trades of the guilds, otherwise than by the greater number of workmen simultaneously employed by one and the same individual capital. The workshop of the medieval master handicraftsman is simply enlarged. At first, therefore, the difference is purely quantitative. We have shown that the surplus value produced by a given capital is equal to the surplus value produced by each workman, multiplied by the number of workmen simultaneously employed. The number of workmen in itself does not affect either the rate of surplus value or the degree of exploitation of labour power. If a working day of 12 hours be embodied in 6 shillings, 1,200 such days will be embodied in 1,200 times 6 shillings. In one case, 12 times 1,200 working hours, and in the other, 12 such hours, are incorporated in the product. In the production of a value, a number of workmen rank merely as so many individual workmen, and it therefore makes no difference in the value produced whether the 1,200 men work separately or united under the control of one capitalist. Nevertheless, within certain limits, a modification takes place. The labour realised in value is labour of an average social quality, is consequently the expenditure of average labour power. Any average magnitude, however, is merely the average of a number of separate magnitudes, all of one kind, but differing as to quantity. In every industry, each individual labourer, be he Peter or Paul, differs from the average labourer. These individual differences, or errors, as they are called in mathematics, compensate one another and vanish whenever a certain minimum number of workmen are employed together. The celebrated sophist and sycophant Edmund Burke goes so far as to make the following assertion, based on his practical observations as a farmer, viz., that in so small a platoon as that of 5 farm labourers, all individual differences in the labour vanish, and that consequently any five adult farm labourers taken together will in the same time do as much work as any other five. Footnote. Unquestionably, there is a good deal of difference between the value of one man's labour and that of another, from strength, dexterity, and honest application. But I am quite sure, from my best observation, that any given five men will, in their total, afford a proportion of labour equal to any other five within the periods of life I have stated. That is, that among such five men there will be one possessing all the qualifications of a good workman, one bad, and the other three middling and approximating to the first and the last. So that in so small a platoon as that of even five, you will find the full complement of all that five men can earn. E. Burke. Compare Ketele on the average individual. End of footnote. But however that may be, it is clear that the collective working day of a large number of workmen simultaneously employed, divided by the number of these workmen, gives one day of average social labour. For example, let the working day of each individual be 12 hours. Then the collective working day of 12 men simultaneously employed consists of 144 hours. And although the labour of each of the dozen men may deviate more or less from average social labour, each of them requiring a different time for the same operation, yet since the working day of each is 1/12 of the collective working day of 144 hours, it possesses the qualities of an average social working day. From the point of view, however, of the capitalist who employs these 12 men, the working day is that of the whole dozen. Each individual man's day is an aliquot part of the collective working day, no matter whether the 12 men assist one another in their work, or whether the connection between their operations consists merely in the fact that the men are all working for the same capitalist. But if the 12 men are employed in 6 pairs, by as many different small masters, it will be quite a matter of chance whether each of these masters produces the same value, and consequently whether he realizes the general rate of surplus value. Deviations would occur in individual cases. If one workman required considerably more time for the production of a commodity than is socially necessary, the duration of the necessary labour time would, in his case, sensibly deviate from the labour time socially necessary on an average, and consequently his labour would not count as average labour, nor his labour power as average labour power. It would either be not saleable at all, or only at something below the average value of labour power. A fixed minimum of efficiency in all labour is therefore assumed, and we shall see later on that capitalist production provides the means of fixing this minimum. Nevertheless, the minimum deviates from the average, although, on the other hand, the capitalist has to pay the average value of labour power. Of the 6 small masters, one would therefore squeeze out more than the average rate of surplus value, another less. The inequalities would be compensated for the society at large, but not for the individual masters. Thus the laws of the production of value are only fully realized for the individual producer when he produces as a capitalist and employs a number of workmen together, whose labor, by its collective nature, is at once stamped as average social labor. Footnote. Professor Roche claims to have discovered that one needlewoman employed by Mrs. Roche during 2 days does more work than 2 needlewomen employed together during 1 day. The learned professor should not study the capitalist process of production in the nursery, nor under circumstances where the principal personage, the capitalist, is wanting. End of footnote. Even without an alteration in the system of working, the simultaneous employment of a large number of labourers effects a revolution in the material conditions of the labour process. the buildings in which they work, the storehouses for the raw material, the implements and utensils used simultaneously or in turns by the workmen. In short, a portion of the means of production are now consumed in common. On the one hand, the exchange value of these means of production is not increased, for the exchange value of a commodity is not raised by its use value being consumed more thoroughly and to greater advantage. On the other hand, they are used in common, and therefore on a larger scale than before. A room where 20 weavers work at 20 looms must be larger than the room of a single weaver with two assistants. But it costs less labour to build one workshop for 20 persons than to build 10 to accommodate 2 weavers each. Thus, the value of the means of production that are concentrated for use in common on a large scale does not increase in direct proportion to the expansion and to the increased useful effect of those means. When consumed in common, they give up a smaller part of their value to each single product, partly because the total value they part with is spread over a greater quantity of products, and partly because their value, though absolutely greater, is having regard to their sphere of action in the process relatively less than the value of isolated means of production. Owing to this, the value of a part of the constant capital falls, and in proportion to the magnitude of the fall, the total value of the commodity also falls. The effect is the same as if the means of production had cost less. The economy in their application is entirely owing to their being consumed in common by a large number of workmen. Moreover, this character of being necessary conditions of social labour, a character that distinguishes them from the dispersed and relatively more costly means of production of isolated independent labourers or small masters, is acquired even when the numerous workmen assembled together do not assist one another, but merely work side by side. A portion of the instruments of labour acquires the social character before the labour process itself does so. Economy in the use of the means of production has to be considered under two aspects. First, as cheapening commodities, and thereby bringing about a fall in the value of labour power. Secondly, as altering the ratio of the surplus value to the total capital advanced, that is, to the sum of the values of the constant and variable capital. The latter aspect will not be considered until we come to the third book, to which, with the object of treating them in their proper connection, we also relegate many other points that relate to the present question. The march of our analysis compels this splitting up of the subject matter, a splitting up that is quite in keeping with the spirit of capitalist production. For since, in this mode of production, the workman finds the instruments of labour existing independently of him as another man's property, economy in their use appears, with regard to him, to be a distinct operation, one that does not concern him, and which, therefore, has no connection with the methods by which his own personal productiveness is increased. When numerous labourers work together side by side, whether in one and the same process, or in different but connected processes, they are said to cooperate, or to work in cooperation. Footnote. Concours de force. Destut de Tracy. End of footnote. Just as the offensive power of a squadron of cavalry or the defensive power of a regiment of infantry is essentially different from the sum of the offensive or defensive powers of the individual cavalry or infantry soldiers taken separately, so the sum total of the mechanical forces exerted by isolated workmen differs from the social force that is developed when many hands take part simultaneously in one and the same undivided operation, such as raising a heavy weight, turning a winch, or removing an obstacle. Footnote. There are numerous operations of so simple a kind as not to admit a division into parts, which cannot be performed without the cooperation of many pairs of hands. I would instance the lifting of a large tree onto a wain. Everything, in short, which cannot be done unless a great many pairs of hands help each other in the same undivided employment and at the same time. E.G. Wakefield, A View of the Art of Colonization, London, 1849. In such cases, the effect of the combined labour could either not be produced at all by isolated individual labour, or it could only be produced by a great expenditure of time, or on a very dwarfed scale. Not only have we here an increase in the productive power of the individual by means of cooperation, but the creation of a new power, namely, the collective power of masses. Footnote. As one man cannot, and 10 men must strain to lift a ton of weight, yet 100 men can do it only by the strength of a finger of each of them. John Betters, Proposals for Raising a College of Industry, London, 1696. End of footnote. Apart from the new power that arises from the fusion of many forces into one single force, mere social contact begets in most industries an emulation and a stimulation of the animal spirits that heighten the efficiency of each individual workman. Hence it is that 12 persons working together will, in their collective working day of 144 hours, produce far more than 12 isolated men, each working 12 hours, or than one man who works 12 days in succession. Footnote. There is also, when the same number of men are employed by one farmer on 300 acres, instead of by 10 farmers with 30 acres apiece, an advantage in the proportion of servants, which will not so easily be understood but by practical men. For it is natural to say, as 1 is to 4, so are 3 to 12. But this will not hold good in practice, for in harvest time, and many other operations which require that kind of dispatch by the throwing many hands together, the work is better and more expeditiously done. For instance, in harvest, 2 drivers, 2 loaders, 2 pitchers, 2 rakers, and the rest at the rick or in the barn, will dispatch double the work that the same number of hands would do if divided into different gangs on different farms. An inquiry into the connection between the present price of provisions and the size of farms, by a farmer, London, 1773, end of footnote. The reason of this is that man is, if not as Aristotle contends, a political, at all events a social animal. Footnote. Strictly, Aristotle's definition is that man is by nature a town citizen. This is quite as characteristic of ancient classical society as Franklin's definition of man as a tool-making animal is characteristic of Yankeedom. End of footnote. Although a number of men may be occupied together at the same time on the same or the same kind of work, yet the labour of each, as a part of the collective labour, may correspond to a distinct phase of the labour process, through all whose phases, in consequence of cooperation, the subject of their labour passes with greater speed. For instance, if 12 masons place themselves in a row so as to pass stones from the foot of a ladder to its summit, each of them does the same thing. Nevertheless, their separate acts form connected parts of one total operation. They are particular phases, which must be gone through by each stone. And the stones are thus carried up quicker by the 24 hands of the row of men than they could be if each man went separately up and down the ladder with his burden. Footnote. It should be noted further that this partial division of labour can occur even when the workers are engaged in the same task. Masons, for example, engaged in passing bricks from hand to hand to a higher stage of the building, are all performing the same task, and yet there does exist amongst them a sort of division of labour. This consists in the fact that each of them passes the brick through a given space, and, taken together, they make it arrive much more quickly at the required spot than they would do if each of them carried his brick separately to the upper story. F. Scarbeck, Théorie des richesses sociales, Paris, 1839. End of footnote. The object is carried over the same distance in a shorter time. Again, a combination of labour occurs whenever a building, for instance, is taken in hand on different sides simultaneously. Although here also, the cooperating masons are doing the same or the same kind of work. The 12 masons, in their collective working day of 144 hours, make much more progress with the building than one mason could make working for 12 days, or 144 hours. The reason is that a body of men working in concert has hands and eyes both before and behind, and is, to a certain degree, omnipresent. The various parts of the work progress simultaneously. In the above instances, we have laid stress upon the point that the men do the same or the same kind of work, because this, the most simple form of labour in common, plays a great part in cooperation, even in its most fully developed stage. If the work be complicated, then the mere number of the men who cooperate allows of the various operations being apportioned to different hands, and, consequently, of being carried on simultaneously. The time necessary for the completion of the whole work is thereby shortened. Footnote. Is it a question of undertaking a complex piece of labour? Many things must be done simultaneously. One person does one thing, while another does something else, and they all contribute to an effect that a single man would be unable to produce. One rows, while the other holds the rudder, and a third casts the net or harpoons the fish. In this way, fishing enjoys a success that would be impossible without this cooperation. D'Estout de Tracy. End of footnote. In many industries, there are critical periods determined by the nature of the process during which certain definite results must be obtained. For instance, if a flock of sheep has to be shorn, or a field of wheat to be cut and harvested, the quantity and quality of the product depends on the work being begun and ended within a certain time. In these cases, the time that ought to be taken by the process is prescribed, just as it is in herring fishing. A single person cannot carve a working day of more than, say, 12 hours, out of the natural day, but 100 men cooperating extend the working day to 1,200 hours. The shortness of the time allowed for the work is compensated for by the large mass of labour thrown upon the field of production at the decisive moment. The completion of the task within the proper time depends on the simultaneous application of numerous combined working days. The amount of useful effect depends on the number of labourers. This number, however, is always smaller than the number of isolated labourers required to do the same amount of work in the same period. Footnote. The doing of it, agricultural work, at the critical juncture is of so much the greater consequence. An inquiry into the connection between the present price, etc. In agriculture, there is no more important factor than that of time. Liebig. Über Theorie und Praxis in der Landwirtschaft, 1856. End of footnote. It is owing to the absence of this kind of cooperation that in the western part of the United States, quantities of corn, and in those parts of East India where English rule has destroyed the old communities, quantities of cotton are yearly wasted. Footnote. The next evil is one which one would scarcely expect to find in a country which exports more labour than any other in the world, with the exception, perhaps, of China and England, the impossibility of procuring a sufficient number of hands to clean the cotton. The consequence of this is that large quantities of the crop are left unpicked, while another portion is gathered from the ground when it has fallen, and is of course discoloured and partially rotted, so that for want of labour at the proper season the cultivator is actually forced to submit to the loss of a large part of that crop for which England is so anxiously looking. Bengal Hukaru, bimonthly overland summary of news, 22nd of July, 1861. End of footnote. On the one hand, cooperation allows of the work being carried on over an extended space. It is consequently imperatively called for in certain undertakings such as draining, constructing dikes, irrigation works, and the making of canals, roads, and railways. On the other hand, while extending the scale of production, it renders possible a relative contraction of the arena. This contraction of arena, simultaneous with and arising from extension of scale, whereby a number of useless expenses are cut down, is owing to the conglomeration of labourers, to the aggregation of various processes, and to the concentration of the means of production. Footnote. In the progress of culture, all, and perhaps more than all, the capital and labour which once loosely occupied 500 acres are now concentrated for the more complete tillage of 100. Although, relatively to the amount of capital and labour employed, space is concentrated, it is an enlarged sphere of production as compared to the sphere of production formerly occupied or worked upon by one single independent agent of production. R. Jones, An Essay on the Distribution of Wealth, 1831. End of footnote. The combined working day produces, relatively to an equal sum of isolated working days, a greater quantity of use values, and consequently diminishes the labour time necessary for the production of a given useful effect. Whether the combined working day, in a given case, acquires this increased productive power because it heightens the mechanical force of labour, or extends its sphere of action over a greater space, or contracts the field of production relatively to the scale of production, or at the critical moment sets large masses of labour to work, or excites emulation between individuals and raises their animal spirits, or impresses on the similar operations carried on by a number of men the stamp of continuity and many-sidedness, or performs simultaneously different operations, or economizes the means of production by use in common, or lends to individual labour the character of average social labour, whichever of these be the cause of the increase, the special productive power of the combined working day is, under all circumstances, the social productive power of labour, or the productive power of social labour. This power is due to cooperation itself. When the labourer cooperates systematically with others, he strips off the fetters of his individuality and develops the capabilities of his species. As a general rule, labourers cannot cooperate without being brought together. Their assemblage in one place is a necessary condition of their cooperation. Hence, wage labourers cannot cooperate unless they are employed simultaneously by the same capital, the same capitalist, and unless, therefore, their labour powers are bought simultaneously by him. The total value of these labour powers, or the amount of the wages of these labourers for a day or a week, as the case may be, must be ready in the pocket of the capitalist before the workmen are assembled for the process of production. The payment of 300 workmen at once, though only for one day, requires a greater outlay of capital than does the payment of a smaller number of men week by week during a whole year. Hence the number of the labourers that cooperate, or the scale of cooperation, depends, in the first instance, on the amount of capital that the individual capitalist can spare for the purchase of labour power. In other words, on the extent to which a single capitalist has command over the means of subsistence of a number of labourers. And as with the variable, so it is with the constant capital. For example, the outlay on raw material is 30 times as great for the capitalist who employs 300 men as it is for each of the 30 capitalists who employ 10 men. The value and quantity of the instruments of labour used in common do not, it is true, increase at the same rate as the number of workmen, but they do increase very considerably. Hence, concentration of large masses of the means of production in the hands of individual capitalists is a material condition for the cooperation of wage labourers, and the extent of the cooperation or the scale of production depends on the extent of this concentration. We heard in a former chapter that a certain minimum amount of capital was necessary in order that the number of labourers simultaneously employed, and consequently the amount of surplus value produced, might suffice to liberate the employer himself from manual labour, to convert him from a small master into a capitalist, and thus formally to establish capitalist production. We now see that a certain minimum amount is a necessary condition for the conversion of numerous isolated and independent processes into one combined social process. We also saw that at first the subjection of labour to capital was only a formal result of the fact that the labourer, instead of working for himself, works for, and consequently under, the capitalist. By the cooperation of numerous wage labourers, the sway of capital develops into a requisite for carrying on the labour process itself, into a real requisite of production. That a capitalist should command on the field of production is now as indispensable as that a general should command on the field of battle. All combined labour on a large scale requires, more or less, a directing authority in order to secure the harmonious working of the individual activities and to perform the general functions that have their origin in the action of the combined organism as distinguished from the action of its separate organs. A single violin player is his own conductor. An orchestra requires a separate one. The work of directing, superintending, and adjusting becomes one of the functions of capital, from the moment that the labour under the control of capital becomes cooperative. Once a function of capital, it acquires special characteristics. The directing motive, the end and aim of capitalist production, is to extract the greatest possible amount of surplus value. Footnote. Profits is the sole end of trade. J. Vanderlint. End of footnote. And consequently, to exploit labour power to the greatest possible extent. As the number of the cooperating labourers increases, so too does their resistance to the domination of capital, and with it, the necessity for capital to overcome this resistance by counter-pressure. The control exercised by the capitalist is not only a special function due to the nature of the social labour process and peculiar to that process, but it is, at the same time, a function of the exploitation of a social labour process, and is consequently rooted in the unavoidable antagonism between the exploiter and the living and labouring raw material he exploits. Again, in proportion to the increasing mass of the means of production, now no longer the property of the labourer but of the capitalist, the necessity increases for some effective control over the proper application of those means. Footnote. That Philistine paper, The Spectator, states that after the introduction of a sort of partnership between capitalist and workmen in the Wirework Company of Manchester, the first result was a sudden decrease in waste, the men not seeing why they should waste their own property any more than any other masters. And waste is, perhaps, next to bad debts, the greatest source of manufacturing loss. The same paper finds that the main defect in the Rochdale cooperative experiments is this. They showed that association of workmen could manage shops, mills, and almost all forms of industry with success, and they immediately improved the condition of the men. But then they did not leave a clear place for masters. Quelle horreur! End of footnote. Moreover, the cooperation of wage labourers is entirely brought about by the capital that employs them. Their union into one single productive body and the establishment of a connection between their individual functions are matters foreign and external to them, are not their own act, but the act of the capital that brings and keeps them together. Hence the connection existing between their various labours appears to them, ideally in the shape of a preconceived plan of the capitalist and practically in the shape of the authority of the same capitalist, in the shape of the powerful will of another, who subjects their activity to his aims. If, then, the control of the capitalist is in substance twofold, by reason of the twofold nature of the process of production itself, which on the one hand is a social process for producing use values, on the other a process for creating surplus value, in form, that control is despotic. As cooperation extends its scale, this despotism takes forms peculiar to itself. Just as at first the capitalist is relieved from actual labour so soon as his capital has reached that minimum amount with which capitalist production, as such, begins, so now he hands over the work of direct and constant supervision of the individual workmen and groups of workmen to a special kind of wage labourer. An industrial army of workmen, under the command of a capitalist, requires, like a real army, officers, managers, and sergeants, foremen, overlookers, who, while the work is being done, command in the name of the capitalist. The work of supervision becomes their established and exclusive function. When comparing the mode of production of isolated peasants and artisans with production by slave labour, the political economist counts this labour of superintendence among the faux frais of production. Footnote. Professor Cairns, after stating that the superintendence of labour is a leading feature of production by slaves in the southern states of North America, continues, "The peasant proprietor of the North, appropriating the whole produce of his toil, needs no other stimulus to exertion. Superintendence is here completely dispensed with." Cairns. End of footnote. But, when considering the capitalist mode of production, he, on the contrary, treats the work of control made necessary by the cooperative character of the labour process as identical with the different work of control necessitated by the capitalist character of that process and the antagonism of interests between capitalist and labourer. Footnote. Sir James Stewart, a writer altogether remarkable for his quick eye for the characteristic social distinctions between different modes of production, says, "Why do large undertakings in the manufacturing way ruin private industry, but by coming nearer to the simplicity of slaves?" Principles of Political Economy, London, 1767. End of footnote. It is not because he is a leader of industry that a man is a capitalist. On the contrary, he is a leader of industry because he is a capitalist. The leadership of industry is an attribute of capital, just as in feudal times the functions of general and judge were attributes of landed property. Footnote. Auguste Comte and his school might therefore have shown that feudal lords are an eternal necessity in the same way that they have done in the case of the lords of capital. End of footnote. The labourer is the owner of his labour power until he has done bargaining for its sale with the capitalist. And he can sell no more than what he has, that is, his individual, isolated labour power. This state of things is in no way altered by the fact that the capitalist, instead of buying the labour power of one man, buys that of 100, and enters into separate contracts with 100 unconnected men, instead of with one. He is at liberty to set the 100 men to work, without letting them cooperate. He pays them the value of 100 independent labour powers, but he does not pay for the combined labour power of the 100. Being independent of each other, the labourers are isolated persons, who enter into relations with the capitalist, but not with one another. This cooperation begins only with the labour process, but they have then ceased to belong to themselves. On entering that process, they become incorporated with capital. As cooperators, as members of a working organism, they are but special modes of existence of capital. Hence, the productive power developed by the labourer when working in cooperation is the productive power of capital. This power is developed gratuitously whenever the workmen are placed under given conditions, and it is capital that places them under such conditions. Because this power costs capital nothing, and because, on the other hand, the labourer himself does not develop it before his labour belongs to capital, it appears as a power with which capital is endowed by nature, a productive power that is immanent in capital. The colossal effects of simple cooperation are to be seen in the gigantic structures of the ancient Asiatics, Egyptians, Etruscans, etc. It has happened in times past that these Oriental states, after supplying the expenses of their civil and military establishments, have found themselves in possession of a surplus which they could apply to works of magnificence or utility, and in the construction of these, their command over the hands and arms of almost the entire non-agricultural population has produced stupendous monuments which still indicate their power. The teeming valley of the Nile produced food for a swarming non-agricultural population, and this food, belonging to the monarch and the priesthood, afforded the means of erecting the mighty monuments which filled the land. In moving the colossal statues and vast masses, of which the transport creates wonder, human labour almost alone was prodigally used. The number of the labourers and the concentration of their efforts sufficed. We see mighty coral reefs rising from the depths of the ocean into islands and firm land. Yet each individual depositor is puny, weak, and contemptible. The non-agricultural labours of an Asiatic monarchy have little but their individual bodily exertions to bring to the task, but their number is their strength, and the power of directing these masses gave rise to the palaces and temples, the pyramids, and the armies of gigantic statues, of which the remains astonish and perplex us. It is that confinement of the revenues which feed them to one or a few hands which makes such undertakings possible. Footnote: R. Jones, Textbook of Lectures, etc. The ancient Assyrian, Egyptian, and other collections in London, and in other European capitals, make us eyewitnesses of the modes of carrying on that cooperative labour. End of footnote. This power of Asiatic and Egyptian kings, Etruscan theocrats, etc., has in modern society been transferred to the capitalist, whether he be an isolated, or as in joint stock companies, a collective capitalist. We find cooperation at the dawn of human development among races who live by the chase. Footnote: Langue is improbably right when in his Théorie des lois civiles he declares hunting to be the first form of cooperation, and man-hunting, war, one of the earliest forms of hunting. End of footnote. Cooperation in the agriculture of Indian communities is based, on the one hand, on ownership in common of the means of production, and on the other hand, on the fact that in those cases, each individual has no more torn himself off from the navel string of his tribe or community than each bee has freed itself from connection with the hive. Such cooperation is distinguished from capitalistic cooperation by both of the above characteristics. The sporadic application of cooperation on a large scale in ancient times, in the Middle Ages, and in modern colonies reposes on relations of dominion and servitude, principally on slavery. The capitalistic form, on the contrary, presupposes, from first to last, the free wage labourer, who sells his labour power to capital. Historically, however, this form is developed in opposition to peasant agriculture and to the carrying on of independent handicrafts, whether in guilds or not. Footnote. Peasant agriculture on a small scale and the carrying on of independent handicrafts, which together form the basis of the feudal mode of production and after the dissolution of that system continue side by side with the capitalist mode, also formed the economic foundation of the classical communities at their best, after the primitive form of ownership of land in common had disappeared, and before slavery had seized on production in earnest. End of footnote. From the standpoint of these, capitalistic cooperation does not manifest itself as a particular historical form of cooperation, but cooperation itself appears to be a historical form peculiar to and specifically distinguishing the capitalist process of production. Just as the social productive power of labour that is developed by cooperation appears to be the productive power of capital, so cooperation itself, contrasted with the process of production carried on by isolated independent labourers or even by small employers, appears to be a specific form of the capitalist process of production. It is the first change experienced by the actual labour process when subjected to capital. This change takes place spontaneously. The simultaneous employment of a large number of wage labourers in one and the same process, which is a necessary condition of this change, also forms the starting point of capitalist production. This point coincides with the birth of capital itself. If then, on the one hand, the capitalist mode of production presents itself to us historically as a necessary condition to the transformation of the labour process into a social process, so, on the other hand, this social form of the labour process presents itself as a method employed by a capital for the more profitable exploitation of labour, by increasing that labour's productiveness. In the elementary form under which we have hitherto viewed it, cooperation is a necessary concomitant of all production on a large scale, but it does not in itself represent a fixed form characteristic of a particular epoch in the development of the capitalist mode of production. At the most, it appears to do so, and that only approximately in the handicraft-like beginnings of manufacture, and in that kind of agriculture on a large scale which corresponds to the epoch of manufacture and is distinguished from peasant agriculture mainly by the number of labourers simultaneously employed and by the mass of the means of production concentrated for their use. Footnote. Whether the united skill, industry and emulation of many together on the same work be not the way to advance it? And whether it had been otherwise possible for England to have carried on her woollen manufacture to so great a perfection? Barclay, The Querist, London, 1751. Simple cooperation is always the prevailing form in those branches of production in which capital operates on a large scale, and division of labour and machinery play but a subordinate part. Cooperation ever constitutes the fundamental form of the capitalist mode of production. Nevertheless, the elementary form of cooperation continues to subsist as a particular form of capitalist production side by side with the more developed forms of that mode of production. Chapter 14, Division of Labour and Manufacture. Section 1, Twofold Origin of Manufacture. That cooperation which is based on division of labour assumes its typical form in manufacture, and is the prevalent characteristic form of the capitalist process of production throughout the manufacturing period properly so called. That period, roughly speaking, extends from the middle of the 16th to the last third of the 18th century. Manufacture takes its rise in two ways. 1. By the assemblage, in one workshop under the control of a single capitalist, of labourers belonging to various independent handicrafts, but through whose hands a given article must pass on its way to completion. A carriage, for example, was formerly the product of the labour of a great number of independent artificers, such as wheelwrights, harness-makers, tailors, locksmiths, upholsterers, turners, fringe-makers, glaziers, painters, polishers, gilders, etc. In the manufacture of carriages, however, all these different artificers are assembled in one building, where they work into one another's hands. It is true that a carriage cannot be gilt before it has been made, but if a number of carriages are being made simultaneously, some may be in the hands of the gilders, while others are going through an earlier process. So far, we are still in the domain of simple cooperation, which finds its materials ready to hand in the shape of men and things. But very soon an important change takes place. The tailor, the locksmith, and the other artificers, being now exclusively occupied in carriage-making, each gradually loses, through want of practice, the ability to carry on, to its full extent, his old handicraft. But on the other hand, his activity, now confined in one groove, assumes the form best adapted to the narrowed sphere of action. At first, carriage manufacture is a combination of various independent handicrafts. By degrees, it becomes the splitting up of carriage making into its various detailed processes, each of which crystallizes into the exclusive function of a particular workman, the manufacture, as a whole, being carried on by the men in conjunction. In the same way, cloth manufacture, as also a whole series of other manufactures, arose by combining different handicrafts together under the control of a single capitalist. Footnote. To give a more modern instance, the silk spinning and weaving of Lyon and Nîmes is entirely patriarchal. It employs a large number of women and children, but without exhausting or ruining them. It allows them to stay in their beautiful valleys of the Drôme, the Var, the Isère, the Vaucluse, cultivating their silkworms and unwinding their cocoons. It never becomes a true factory industry. However, the principle of the division of labour takes on a special character here. There do indeed exist winders, throasters, dyers, sizers, and finally weavers, but they are not assembled in the same workshop, nor are they dependent on a single master. They are all independent. A. Blanqui, Cours d'économie industrielle, recueilli par A. Blaise, Paris, 1838-39. Since Blanqui wrote this, the various independent labourers have, to some extent, been united in factories. And since Marx wrote this, the power loom has invaded these factories, and is now, 1886, rapidly superseding the hand loom. Added in the fourth German edition. The Krefeld silk industry also has its tale to tell about this subject. Friedrich Engels. End of footnote. 2. Manufacture also arises in a way exactly the reverse of this, namely by one capitalist employing simultaneously in one workshop a number of artificers who all do the same or the same kind of work, such as making paper, type, or needles. This is cooperation in its most elementary form. Each of these artificers, with the help, perhaps, of one or two apprentices, makes the entire commodity, and he consequently performs in succession all the operations necessary for its production. He still works in his old handicraft-like way. But very soon, external circumstances cause a different use to be made of the concentration of the workmen on one spot, and of the simultaneousness of their work. An increased quantity of the article has, perhaps, to be delivered within a given time. The work is therefore redistributed. Instead of each man being allowed to perform all the various operations in succession, these operations are changed into disconnected, isolated ones, carried on side by side. Each is assigned to a different artificer, and the whole of them together are performed simultaneously by the cooperating workmen. This accidental repartition gets repeated, develops advantages of its own, and gradually ossifies into a systematic division of labour. The commodity, from being the individual product of an independent artificer, becomes the social product of a union of artificers, each of whom performs one, and only one, of the constituent partial operations. The same operations which, in the case of a papermaker belonging to a German guild, merged one into the other as the successive acts of one artificer, became in the Dutch paper manufacture so many partial operations carried on side by side by numerous cooperating labourers. The needlemaker of the Nuremberg Guild was the cornerstone on which the English needle manufacture was raised. But while in Nuremberg that single artificer performed a series of perhaps 20 operations one after another, in England it was not long before there were 20 needlemakers side by side, each performing one alone of those 20 operations, and in consequence of further experience, each of those 20 operations was again split up, isolated, and made the exclusive function of a separate workman. The mode in which manufacture arises, its growth out of handicrafts, is therefore twofold. On the one hand, it arises from the union of various independent handicrafts, which become stripped of their independence and specialized to such an extent as to be reduced to mere supplementary partial processes in the production of one particular commodity. On the other hand, it arises from the cooperation of artificers of one handicraft. It splits up that particular handicraft into its various detail operations, isolating and making these operations independent of one another up to the point where each becomes the exclusive function of a particular labourer. On the one hand, therefore, manufacture either introduces division of labour into a process of production, or further develops that division. On the other hand, it unites together handicrafts that were formerly separate. But whatever may have been its particular starting point, its final form is invariably the same, a productive mechanism whose parts are human beings. For a proper understanding of the division of labour in manufacture, it is essential that the following points be firmly grasped. First, the decomposition of a process of production into its various successive steps coincides here strictly with the resolution of a handicraft into its successive manual operations. Whether complex or simple, each operation has to be done by hand, retains the character of a handicraft, and is therefore dependent on the strength, skill, quickness, and sureness of the individual workman in handling his tools. The handicraft continues to be the basis. This narrow technical basis excludes a really scientific analysis of any definite process of industrial production, since it is still a condition that each detail process, gone through by the product, must be capable of being done by hand and of forming, in its way, a separate handicraft. It is just because handicraft skill continues, in this way, to be the foundation of the process of production, that each workman becomes exclusively assigned to a partial function, and that for the rest of his life, his labour power is turned into the organ of this detail function. Secondly, this division of labour is a particular sort of cooperation, and many of its disadvantages spring from the general character of cooperation, and not from this particular form of it. Section 2. The Detail Labourer and His Implements. If we now go into more detail, it is, in the first place, clear that a labourer who all his life performs one and the same simple operation converts his whole body into the automatic, specialised implement of that operation. Consequently, he takes less time in doing it than the artificer who performs a whole series of operations in succession. But the collective labourer, who constitutes the living mechanism of manufacture, is made up solely of such specialised detailed labourers. Hence, in comparison with the independent handicraft, more is produced in a given time, or the productive power of labour is increased. Footnote. The more any manufacture of much variety shall be distributed and assigned to different artists, the same must needs be better done, and with greater expedition, with less loss of time and labour. The Advantages of the East India Trade, 1720. End of footnote. Moreover, when once this fractional work is established as the exclusive function of one person, the methods it employs become perfected. The workman's continued repetition of the same simple act, and the concentration of his attention on it, teach him by experience how to attain the desired effect with the minimum of exertion. But since there are always several generations of labourers living at one time and working together at the manufacture of a given article, the technical skill, the tricks of the trade thus acquired, become established and are accumulated and handed down. Footnote. Easy labour is transmitted skill. Thomas Hodgkin, Popular Political Economy. End of footnote. Manufacture, in fact, produces the skill of the detail labourer by reproducing and systematically driving to an extreme within the workshop the naturally developed differentiation of trades which it found ready to hand in society at large. On the other hand, the conversion of fractional work into the life-calling of one man corresponds to the tendency shown by earlier societies to make trades hereditary, either to petrify them into castes, or whenever definite historical conditions beget in the individual a tendency to vary in a manner incompatible with the nature of castes, to ossify them into guilds. Castes and guilds arise from the action of the same natural law that regulates the differentiation of plants and animals into species and varieties, except that, when a certain degree of development has been reached, the heredity of castes and the exclusiveness of guilds are ordained as a law of society. Footnote. The arts also have, in Egypt, reached the requisite degree of perfection, for it is the only country where artificers may not in any way meddle with the affairs of another class of citizens, but must follow that calling alone which by law is hereditary in their clan. In other countries it is found that tradesmen divide their attention between too many objects. At one time they try agriculture, at another they take to commerce, at another they busy themselves with two or three occupations at once. In free countries, they mostly frequent the assemblies of the people. In Egypt, on the contrary, every artificer is severely punished if he meddles with affairs of state or carries on several trades at once. Thus there is nothing to disturb their application to their calling. Moreover, since they inherit from their forefathers numerous rules, they are eager to discover fresh advantages. Diodorus Siculus. End of footnote. Quote, "The muslins of Dhaka in fineness, the calicoes and other piece goods of Coromandel in brilliant and durable colours, have never been surpassed. Yet they are produced without capital, machinery, division of labour, or any of those means which give such facilities to the manufacturing interest of Europe. The weaver is merely a detached individual, working a web when ordered of a customer, and with a loom of the rudest construction, consisting sometimes of a few branches or bars of wood put roughly together. There is even no expedient for rolling up the warp. The loom must therefore be kept stretched to its full length, and become so inconveniently large that it cannot be contained within the hut of the manufacturer, who is therefore compelled to ply his trade in the open air, where it is interrupted by every vicissitude of the weather." Unquote. Footnote. Historical and Descriptive Account of British India, etc., by Hugh Murray and James Wilson, etc. The Indian loom is upright, that is, the warp is stretched vertically. End of footnote. It is only the special skill accumulated from generation to generation and transmitted from father to son that gives to the Hindu, as it does to the spider, this proficiency. And yet the work of such a Hindu weaver is very complicated compared with that of a manufacturing labourer. An artificer who performs one after another the various fractional operations in the production of a finished article must at one time change his place, at another his tools. The transition from one operation to another interrupts the flow of his labour, and creates, so to say, gaps in his working day. These gaps close up so soon as he is tied to one and the same operation all day long. They vanish in proportion as the changes in his work diminish. The resulting increased productive power is owing either to an increased expenditure of labour power in a given time, that is, to increased intensity of labour, or to a decrease in the amount of labour power unproductively consumed. The extra expenditure of power demanded by every transition from rest to motion is made up for by prolonging the duration of the normal velocity when once acquired. On the other hand, constant labour of one uniform kind disturbs the intensity and flow of a man's animal spirits, which find recreation and delight in mere change of activity. The productiveness of labour depends not only on the proficiency of the workman, but on the perfection of his tools. Tools of the same kind, such as knives, drills, gimlets, hammers, etc., may be employed in different processes, and the same tool may serve various purposes in a single process. But so soon as the different operations of a labour process are disconnected, the one from the other, and each fractional operation acquires in the hands of the detail labourer a suitable and peculiar form, alterations become necessary in the implements that previously served more than one purpose. The direction taken by this change is determined by the difficulties experienced in consequence of the unchanged form of the implement. Manufacture is characterised by the differentiation of the instruments of labour, a differentiation whereby implements of a given sort acquire fixed shapes, adapted to each particular application, and by the specialization of those instruments, giving to each special implement its full play only in the hands of a specific detail labourer. In Birmingham alone, 500 varieties of hammers are produced, and not only is each adapted to one particular process, but several varieties often serve exclusively for the different operations in one and the same process. The manufacturing period simplifies, improves, and multiplies the implements of labour by adapting them to the exclusively special functions of each detail labourer. Footnote. Darwin, in his epoch-making work on the Origin of Species, remarks with reference to the natural organs of plants and animals, "So long as one and the same organ has different kinds of work to perform, a ground for its changeability may possibly be found in this, that natural selection preserves or suppresses each small variation of form less carefully than if that organ were destined for the one special purpose alone. Thus, knives that are adapted to cut all sorts of things may, on the whole, be of one shape, but an implement destined to be used exclusively in one way must have a different shape for every different use." End of footnote. It thus creates at the same time one of the material conditions for the existence of machinery which consists of a combination of simple instruments. The detail labourer and his implements are the simplest elements of manufacture. Let us now turn to its aspect as a whole. Section 3. The two fundamental forms of manufacture. Heterogeneous manufacture, serial manufacture. The organization of manufacture has two fundamental forms which, in spite of occasional blending, are essentially different in kind and, moreover, play very distinct parts in the subsequent transformation of manufacture into modern industry carried on by machinery. This double character arises from the nature of the article produced. This article either results from the mere mechanical fitting together of partial products made independently, or owes its completed shape to a series of connected processes and manipulations. A locomotive, for instance, consists of more than 5,000 independent parts. It cannot, however, serve as an example of the first kind of genuine manufacture, for it is a structure produced by modern mechanical industry. But a watch can, and William Petty used it to illustrate the division of labour in manufacture. Formerly the individual work of a Nuremberg artificer, the watch has been transformed into the social product of an immense number of detail labourers, such as mainspring makers, dial makers, spiral spring makers, jewelled hole makers, ruby lever makers, hand makers, case makers, screw makers, gilders, with numerous subdivisions such as wheel makers, brass and steel separate, pin makers, movement makers, acheveur des pignons, fixes the wheels on the axles, polishes the facets, etc. Pivot makers, planteur de finissage, puts the wheels and springs in the works. Finisseur de barrier, cuts teeth in the wheels, makes the holes of the right size, etc. Escapement makers, cylinder makers for cylinder escapements, escapement wheel makers, balance wheel makers, racket makers, apparatus for regulating the watch. The planteur d'échappement, escapement maker proper. Then the repasseur de barrier, finishes the box for the spring, etc. Steel polishers, wheel polishers, screw polishers, figure painters, dial enamelers, melt the enamel on the copper. Fabricant de pendant, makes the ring by which the case is hung. Finisseur de charnière, puts the brass hinge in the cover, etc. Faiseur de secret, puts in the springs that open the case. Graveur, ciseleur, polisseur de boîte, etc., etc., and last of all, the repasseur, who fits together the whole watch and hands it over in a going state. Only a few parts of the watch pass through several hands, and all these membra disjecta come together for the first time in the hand that binds them into one mechanical whole. This external relation between the finished product and its various and diverse elements makes it, as well in this case as in the case of all similar finished articles, a matter of chance whether the detail labourers are brought together in one workshop or not. The detail operations may further be carried on like so many independent handicrafts, as they are in the cantons of Vaud and Neufchâtel, while in Geneva there exist large watch manufactories where the detail labourers directly cooperate under the control of a single capitalist. And even in the latter case, the dial, the springs and the case are seldom made in the factory itself. To carry on the trade as a manufacture, with concentration of workmen, is in the watch trade profitable only under exceptional conditions, because competition is greater between the labourers who desire to work at home, and because the splitting up of the work into a number of heterogeneous processes permits but little use of the instruments of labour in common, and the capitalist, by scattering the work, saves the outlay on workshops, etc. Footnote. In the year 1854, Geneva produced 80,000 watches, which is not one-fifth of the production in the canton of Neufchâtel. La Chaux-de-Fonds alone, which we may look upon as a huge watch manufactory, produces yearly twice as many as Geneva. From 1850 to 61, Geneva produced 720,000 watches. See Report from Geneva on the Watch Trade in Reports by HM Secretaries of Embassy and Legation on the Manufactures, Commerce, etc., No. 6, 1863. The want of connection alone between the processes into which the production of articles that merely consist of parts fitted together is split up makes it very difficult to convert such a manufacture into a branch of modern industry carried on by machinery. But in the case of a watch, there are two other impediments in addition: the minuteness and delicacy of its parts, and its character as an article of luxury. Hence their variety, which is such that in the best London houses scarcely a dozen watches are made alike in the course of a year. The watch manufactory of Messrs. Vacheron and Constantin, in which machinery has been employed with success, produces at the most three or four different varieties of size and form. End of footnote. Nevertheless, the position of this detail labourer who, though he works at home, does so for a capitalist, manufacturer, établisseur, is very different from that of the independent artificer who works for his own customers. Footnote. In watchmaking, that classical example of heterogeneous manufacture, we may study with great accuracy the aforementioned differentiation and specialization of the instruments of labor caused by the subdivision of handicrafts. End of footnote. The second kind of manufacture, its perfected form, produces articles that go through connected phases of development through a series of processes step by step, like the wire in the manufacture of needles, which passes through the hands of 72 and sometimes even 92 different detail workmen. In so far as such a manufacture, when first started, combines scattered handicrafts, it lessens the space by which the various phases of production are separated from each other. The time taken in passing from one stage to another is shortened, so is the labour that effectuates this passage. Footnote. In so close a cohabitation of the people, the carriage must needs be less. The advantages of the East India trade. End of footnote. In comparison with a handicraft, productive power is gained, and this gain is owing to the general cooperative character of manufacture. On the other hand, division of labour, which is the distinguishing principle of manufacture, requires the isolation of the various stages of production and their independence of each other. The establishment and maintenance of a connection between the isolated functions necessitates the incessant transport of the article from one hand to another, and from one process to another. From the standpoint of modern mechanical industry, this necessity stands forth as a characteristic and costly disadvantage, and one that is eminent in the principle of manufacture. Footnote. The isolation of the different stages of manufacture, consequent upon the employment of manual labour, adds immensely to the cost of production, the loss mainly arising from the mere removals from one process to another. The Industry of Nations, 1855. End of footnote. If we confine our attention to some particular lot of raw materials, of rags, for instance, in paper manufacture, or of wire in needle manufacture, we perceive that it passes in succession through a series of stages in the hands of the various detail workmen until completion. On the other hand, if we look at the workshop as a whole, we see the raw material in all the stages of its production at the same time. The collective labourer, with one set of his many hands, armed with one kind of tools, draws the wire. With another set, armed with different tools, he at the same time straightens it. With another, he cuts it. With another, points it, and so on. The different detail processes, which were successive in time, have become simultaneous, go on side by side in space. Hence, production of a greater quantum of finished commodities in a given time. Footnote. It, the division of labour, produces also an economy of time by separating the work into its different branches, all of which may be carried on into execution at the same moment. By carrying on all the different processes at once, which an individual must have executed separately, it becomes possible to produce a multitude of pins completely finished in the same time as a single pin might have been either cut or pointed. Dugald Stewart. End of footnote. This simultaneity, it is true, is due to the general cooperative form of the process as a whole. But manufacture not only finds the conditions for cooperation ready to hand, it also, to some extent, creates them by the subdivision of handicraft labour. On the other hand, it accomplishes this social organisation of the labour process only by riveting each labourer to a single fractional detail. Since the fractional product of each detail labourer is, at the same time, only a particular stage in the development of one and the same finished article, each labourer, or each group of labourers, prepares the raw material for another labourer or group. The result of the labour of the one is the starting point for the labour of the other. The one workman, therefore, gives occupation directly to the other. The labour time necessary in each partial process for attaining the desired effect is learnt by experience, and the mechanism of manufacture as a whole is based on the assumption that a given result will be obtained in a given time. It is only on this assumption that the various supplementary labour processes can proceed uninterruptedly, simultaneously, and side by side. It is clear that this direct dependence of the operations, and therefore of the labourers, on each other, compels each one of them to spend on his work no more than the necessary time, and thus a continuity, uniformity, regularity, order, and even intensity of labour, of quite a different kind, is begotten than is to be found in an independent handicraft, or even in simple cooperation. Footnote. The more variety of artists to every manufacture, the greater the order and regularity of every work. The same must needs be done in less time, the labour must be less. The advantages, etc. End of footnote. The rule that the labour time expended on a commodity should not exceed that which is socially necessary for its production appears in the production of commodities generally to be established by the mere effect of competition, since, to express ourselves superficially, each single producer is obliged to sell his commodity at its market price. In manufacture, on the contrary, the turning out of a given quantum of product in a given time is a technical law of the process of production itself. Footnote. Nevertheless, the manufacturing system, in many branches of industry, attains this result but very imperfectly, because it knows not how to control with certainty the general chemical and physical conditions of the process of production. End of footnote. Different operations take, however, unequal periods, and yield, therefore, in equal times, unequal quantities of fractional products. If, therefore, the same labourer has, day after day, to perform the same operation, there must be a different number of labourers for each operation. For instance, in type manufacture, there are 4 founders and 2 breakers to 1 rubber. The founder casts 2,000 type an hour, the breaker breaks up 4,000, and the rubber polishes 8,000. Here we have again the principle of cooperation in its simplest form, the simultaneous employment of many doing the same thing. Only now, this principle is the expression of an organic relation. The division of labour, as carried out in manufacture, not only simplifies and multiplies the qualitatively different parts of the social collective labourer, but also creates a fixed mathematical relation or ratio which regulates the quantitative extent of those parts. That is, the relative number of labourers, or the relative size of the group of labourers for each detail operation. It develops, along with the qualitative subdivision of the social labour process, a quantitative rule and proportionality for that process. When once the most fitting proportion has been experimentally established for the numbers of the detail labourers in the various groups when producing on a given scale, that scale can be extended only by employing a multiple of each particular group. Footnote. When, from the peculiar nature of the produce of each manufactory, the number of processes into which it is most advantageous to divide it is ascertained, as well as the number of individuals to be employed, then all other manufactories which do not employ a direct multiple of this number will produce the article at a greater cost. Hence arises one of the causes of the great size of manufacturing establishments. See Babbage, On the Economy of Machinery, 1832, end of footnote. There is this to boot, that the same individual can do certain kinds of work just as well on a large as on a small scale. For instance, the labour of superintendence, the carriage of the fractional product from one stage to the next, etc. The isolation of such functions, their allotment to a particular labourer, does not become advantageous till after an increase in the number of labourers employed. But this increase must affect every group proportionally. The isolated group of labourers to whom any particular detail function is assigned is made up of homogeneous elements, and is one of the constituent parts of the total mechanism. In many manufactures, however, the group itself is an organised body of labour, the total mechanism being a repetition or multiplication of these elementary organisms. Take, for instance, the manufacture of glass bottles. It may be resolved into 3 essentially different stages. First, the preliminary stage, consisting of the preparation of the components of the glass, mixing the sand and lime, etc., and melting them into a fluid mass of glass. Footnote. In England, the melting furnace is distinct from the glass furnace in which the glass is manipulated. In Belgium, one and the same furnace serves for both processes. End of footnote. Various detail labourers are employed in this first stage, as also in the final one of removing the bottles from the drying furnace, sorting and packing them, etc. In the middle, between these two stages, comes the glass melting proper, the manipulation of the fluid mass. At each mouth of the furnace there works a group called the hole, consisting of one bottle maker or finisher, one blower, one gatherer, one putter up or wetter off, and one taker in. These five detail workers are so many special organs of a single working organism that acts only as a whole, and therefore can operate only by the direct cooperation of the whole five. The whole body is paralyzed if but one of its members be wanting. But a glass furnace has several openings, in England from 4 to 6, each of which contains an earthenware melting pot full of molten glass, and employs a similar 5-membered group of workers. The organization of each group is based on division of labor, but the bond between the different groups is simple cooperation, which, by using in common one of the means of production, the furnace, causes it to be more economically consumed. Such a furnace, with its 4 to 6 groups, constitutes a glass house, and a glass manufactory comprises a number of such glass houses, together with the apparatus and workmen requisite for the preparatory and final stages. Finally, just as manufacture arises in part from the combination of various handicrafts, so too it develops into a combination of various manufactures. The larger English glass manufacturers, for instance, make their own earthenware melting pots, because on the quality of these depends to a great extent the success or failure of the process. The manufacture of one of the means of production is here united with that of the product. On the other hand, the manufacture of the product may be united with other manufactures, of which that product is the raw material, or with the products of which it is itself subsequently mixed. Thus we find the manufacture of flint glass combined with that of glass cutting and brass founding, the latter for the metal settings of various articles of glass. The various manufactures, so combined, form more or less separate departments of a large manufacture, but are at the same time independent processes, each with its own division of labour. In spite of the many advantages offered by this combination of manufactures, it never grows into a complete technical system on its own foundation. That happens only on its transformation into an industry carried on by machinery. Early in the manufacturing period, the principle of lessening the necessary labour time in the production of commodities is accepted and formulated, and the use of machines, especially for certain simple first processes that have to be conducted on a very large scale, and with the application of great force, sprang up here and there. Footnote. This can be seen from W. Petty, John Bellers, Andrew Yarranton, The Advantages of the East India Trade, and J. Vanderlint, not to mention others. End of footnote. Thus, at an early period in paper manufacture, the tearing up of the rags was done by paper mills, and in metalworks, the pounding of the ores was effected by stamping mills. Footnote. Towards the end of the 16th century, mortars and sieves were still used in France for pounding and washing ores. End of footnote. The Roman Empire had handed down the elementary form of all machinery in the water wheel. Footnote. The whole history of the development of machinery can be traced in the history of the corn mill. The factory in England is still a mill. In German technological works of the first decade of this century, the term Mühle is still found in use, not only for all machinery driven by the forces of nature, but also for all manufactures where apparatus in the nature of machinery is applied. The handicraft period bequeathed to us the great inventions of the compass, of gunpowder, of type printing, and of the automatic clock. But on the whole, machinery played that subordinate part which Adam Smith assigns to it in comparison with division of labour. Footnote. As will be seen more in detail in the fourth book of this work, Adam Smith has not established a single new proposition relating to division of labour. What, however, characterises him as the political economist par excellence of the period of manufacture is the stress he lays on division of labour. The subordinate part, which he assigns to machinery, gave occasion in the early days of modern mechanical industry to the polemic of Lauderdale, and at a later period to that of Ure. A. Smith also confounds differentiation of the instruments of labour, in which the detail labourers themselves took an active part, with the invention of machinery. In this latter, it is not the workmen in the manufactories, but learned men, handicraftsmen, and even peasants, brackets Brindley, who play a part. End of footnote. The sporadic use of machinery in the 17th century was of the greatest importance, because it supplied the great mathematicians of that time with a practical basis and stimulant to the creation of the science of mechanics. The collective labourer, formed by the combination of a number of detail labourers, is the machinery specially characteristic of the manufacturer.